We're going to do two things today. First, we're going to have our second of the NMR lectures. This won't be quite as heavy or as theory intensive as the first one was. And in fact, we're going to focus on structure today. So this idea of chemical equivalency that came up during lecture, we're going to explore that for the next half hour or so. Then we're going to actually go into the instrument room and learn how to use the NMR machine. Reason I want to do that today is because NMR is supposed to be a component of your next lab, but we also have the GC, the gas chromatography, that's left for us to do. But because there could potentially be a line for both devices, I thought it would make sense, be more efficient time-wise, if we go over the directions for the NMR today. We'll have a brief pre-lab on Monday, where we'll talk about the reaction itself, which is pretty straightforward as far as physically performing the reaction. And then I'll briefly review NMR and show you, because the GC is very easy to use, so then I'll show you how to use the GC. But that way, whichever device you happen to be ready to use, either the GC or the NMR, hopefully this will spread us out a little bit on the machines, and so we won't have as much of a backlog. So in the long run, we'll have a better chance of making sure everybody gets through. So to the theory part for today, let's talk about chemical equivalency. So this is the same exact, yes, I'm sorry. This is lab lecture. Anything NMR related is just going to be lab. So this is the same compound that you saw in free radical halogenation, 2-methylbutane. And the question came up during that lecture of how many different types of hydrogens are there on this compound. And the way we could figure that out in the case that we've done so far is to imagine that we put something like chlorine at each carbon, and we could decide whether or not that's going to generate a unique compound. In general, if we have two atoms that we say are chemically equivalent, that means if you go from that atom, or either atom that you're comparing, and examine the structure, the whole molecule, relative to where that atom is positioned, if when you compare two atoms and they have exactly the same neighbors and then neighbors of neighbors and so on and so forth across the molecule, then those two atoms are chemically equivalent, that they are identical. So in fact, let me write that definition down, and then I'll show you on this example molecule atoms that are equivalent and atoms that aren't equivalent. So if the chemical environment around two atoms is identical, meaning that the neighbors for both atoms are identical across the whole molecule, the atoms are chemically equivalent. Which, the reason that's important for NMR is that, other than some exceptions that we'll talk about, every unique chemically inequivalent hydrogen or carbon, every one that's not the same, generates its own signal. So I'll say it this way. A unique NMR signal is generated for each unique type of atom. So if we find four different kinds of hydrogens, in principle, we're going to find four NMR peaks. Later, we'll discover that if the environments are incredibly similar, that maybe you won't be able to distinguish them by NMR. But technically, if they're inequivalent, they're inequivalent. So now let's look at this example molecule, and let's identify the different types of hydrogens that are on here. And actually, I'm going to limit my discussion for today's lecture to just hydrogen, because it's the type of spectrum that we're going to acquire first. And it actually turns out it's the tougher NMR technique to handle. But in other words, once we get through it, when we come back to carbon, either later this quarter or early next quarter, it'll be a breeze. So one way we could differentiate between the different positions of this molecule is just to focus on the fact that we have primary versus secondary versus tertiary carbons. So I could identify right away that I have this tertiary hydrogen, which is going to definitely be different in nature than a secondary hydrogen. But then we have three methyl groups, three ends of the molecules. Are all three of those the same? Or are any of them the same as each other? Well, let's say I start here. If I see what its neighbor is, it's a tertiary carbon. But look at the methyl group up above it. It also has the same tertiary carbon as its neighbor. On top of that, since they are joined at the same branch, the rest of the molecule structure is identical for both of those atoms. So because their immediate neighbor is the same, and because therefore the rest of the molecule is the same, those two methyl groups are chemically equivalent to each other. But if I look at this other position, this methyl group, it has as a neighbor a secondary carbon, not a tertiary carbon. That's going to have a chemical effect. It's going to have different kind of reactivity. Related to NMR means it's going to have a different magnetic environment. And so the methyl group on the right-hand side of the molecule is not the same as the methyl groups on the left-hand side of the molecule. Again, since you all have had the lecture this morning, I could also say it this way. Put a chlorine on one methyl group versus the other, you get two unique products, which means they were two different hydrogens to begin with. If I put a chlorine in either of the left-hand methyl groups, though, the two products would be identical, which means those hydrogens were identical. And again, the reason we care about this is because if I identify four different kinds of hydrogens, that in principle means I'm going to have four different NMR signals when I analyze this compound. Now let's see a slightly more complicated example, though. So another molecule that's not totally symmetric. The reason I'm giving this example is to show it's not the immediate neighbor alone that matters, but it matters all up and down the molecule. It's kind of like the first point of difference rule. If you go from the two positions you're comparing, and if you find any differences as you travel their paths, well, then that means they're two different atoms. So, for example, the two methyl groups on the left and the two methyl groups on the right. If you weren't paying close attention, you might say, oh, all four of them are exactly the same because all four of them are connected to a tertiary carbon. But are those the same tertiary carbons? Because look one more position away. On the left-hand side, that first tertiary carbon is located next to another tertiary carbon. But on the right-hand side, that tertiary carbon is connected instead to a secondary carbon. Since these junction points, the tertiary carbons, are not the same as each other, anything that's attached to them is automatically not equivalent either. Again, start from a left-hand methyl group. I could go to carbon with a chain and a methyl, carbon with a chain and methyl group. From the other side, I get to carbon with a chain and a methyl group. Then I get to something that just has the rest of the chain, no methyl group there. So from either side of the molecule, those are different hydrogens. Now back to what we had in the first example, though. Since these two methyl groups on the left are attached to a common point, these two are equivalent with each other, because you would get the same exact structure if you started from either point. Yes? This one is not identical to that one, but it is identical to this one. Right. So let me mark out all the different types of hydrogens on this molecule. So we have the methyl groups on the left. And realize I'm only writing in one of the hydrogens that might be at these different positions. Then we have the tertiary position. We have the next tertiary position over. We have the methyl group attached at that point, which is unique. Running out of colors here. We have the secondary position. We have the next tertiary position. And then we have the last type of methyl group. So there are seven different types of hydrogens in this molecule. So in theory, we're going to get seven different signals. Yes? See, well, actually, this right here, you could stop and say, this is a methyl group. This is not a methyl group, even. Notice this is a hydrogen attached to a methyl, attached to the rest of the chain. And this is a hydrogen directly attached to the chain itself. No methyl group in between. So they're totally not equivalent. Now, back up to the way I've written it, because both this morning and just now, I guess my wordsmithing ability is weak today. So I'm not satisfied with the way I expressed it, but what I'm trying to say here as far as identical across the whole molecule, this second molecule is trying to show you an example of that, where you don't just look next door. You don't just say, oh, there's a tertiary here, there's a tertiary here, so all those methyl groups are the same. You do have to examine the entire molecule and see if from either direction there's any differences that occur. Yeah. That's what I just got done saying. No, they're not the same. Why wouldn't they be the same? The next one's not the same, exactly. So that's why we can't put them all into the same group. It's because we don't what? Oh, why do they do it the same color? I see what you're asking. Yeah, I don't have enough plants. Now, this is the simple case of what causes things to be inequivalent by having primary versus secondary or functional groups around. You know, if I put a functional group anywhere, like if I put an alcohol right here where my finger is, now these two methyl groups would no longer be the same because one has a functional group, one doesn't. So the only one in that case that would be equivalent would be the ones at the end here. But there's a sneakier case of how many equivalent hydrogens we have or don't have. Which is this? So if I'm telling you it's sneaky, then you might want to second guess your first answer. Or you could just tell me, what do you think is the number of different hydrogens on here? How many would you say? Different types. Five? The oxygen has a hydrogen its own self, doesn't it? So sure, that hydrogen counts. Let's label that as one of our hydrogens then. We have the methyl group on the left. Is it different than the methyl group on the right? Yes, because the one I just wrote a hydrogen for is only one position away from the OH group. The other end of the molecule, though, is two positions away. So they're definitely different from each other. There's the hydrogen where the OH group is located. And then we have one more carbon that has two more hydrogens. But notice the note I just made below here. They're not equivalent to each other. So five is the correct first guess. But why is it really the answer six? Why are the two protons at what I've labeled as HE not the same as each other? Can anybody think of a reasonable explanation? Well, it might help if I drew a rotamer. Now the way I've drawn it, could you come up with a reason why those two might not be the same as each other? Did someone say sterics? Good guess, but not correct in this case, because it's not a reaction that's happening. It's, well, wait a minute. When you say sterics, what do you mean by that? So maybe they'd bump into each other? What if they weren't big enough to have a steric influence? But you're still on the right track because the OH group is closer to one of the hydrogens than the other. Now, I know that you probably did not review your NMR notes at all because they weren't on the exam, and being purely realistic, you got to survive the exam before you worry about NMR, right? But one of the central ideas of that last lecture is that if you have an electron withdrawing group nearby, it's going to pull electron density away and cause a higher chemical shift. Well, one of these two hydrogens is pointed the same way as that OH group, and it's going to be closer to the electron withdrawing effect of oxygen. Even if it's not through the bond, there are what are known as through space effects. That electron density can be pulled even if it's not along a bond. The other hydrogen, the one written with the dash, pointed away from the OH group, further from the OH group, close enough, of course, that the oxygen is still going to have a big inductive effect, but further away, so it is a different effect than the proton that is pointed the same direction. So because in space, if you could stop that molecule just for a moment and keep that orientation the same, one interaction with the hydrogen and the OH group is different than the other hydrogen and that OH group, so they're not chemically equivalent.
So first I'll summarize and I'll say the interactions between the two indicated hydrogens, meaning the two hydrogens I wrote in. Are different since the two hydrogens are different distances from the OH group. Therefore, the hydrogens are chemically inequivalent.
Now, there's a term that can be used in general to describe exactly this kind of situation. And let me tell you where this term comes from, then relate it back to what physically is going on.
If we had something like this, chiral alcohol. And let's say there was some kind of process that occurred.
Putting the word magic here, just maybe because I might get a smile, but more because it doesn't matter what the reaction is. The idea is I'm going to replace one or the other of the hydrogens at that secondary position with some mythical functional group, which I'll call X. But that doesn't mean halogen in this case. That means just something different.
In fact, just to make sure that we're not confusing it with a halogen, I'll go ahead and just write Z instead.
Well, then I've taken one molecule and have turned it into two different what's. What is the relationship between these two molecules I just wrote? Diastereomer, right? Because I only changed one of the two stereocenters on this molecule. Because of that, these are called diastereotopic protons.
I should know what that root word topic means. I don't think it means item of discussion.
I'll go off and look at what it means. But what the term means is if you replace either of the hydrogens, you're going to generate diastereomers.
So if by replacing one hydrogen versus another, a pair of diastereomers are formed, the hydrogens are called diastereotopic.
And because we have this different interaction of the chiral center that really is there versus its neighbors, that's why this term diastereotopic matters. It's not that somehow magically a reaction is going to happen. Again, no reaction's really happening. We're just talking about a structural relationship. And that relationship is exactly the fact that in this example molecule, the two neighboring hydrogens are different distances from the OH group. And because anytime that you have diastereotopic protons, you would have that potential difference for behavior, diastereotopic protons are always chemically inequivalent. Now, if you have the term diastereotopic, you might imagine, okay, or guess, that there might be a term enantiotopic. And there is. So if we had something like plain old butane, if I asked you how many different types of protons are on that molecule, what would the answer be? Two? Well, is the molecule symmetric? Yes, it is. From one end of the molecule versus the other, would you get the same structure if you walked along the molecule either direction? Okay. But we do have a secondary versus a primary carbon, so they are two different positions. And so, yes, normally we would say there are two different types of hydrogens. But it actually depends on what solvent you're in. So first, let me write out what the term enantiotopic means. Enantiotopic means if you replace a hydrogen, one hydrogen versus another, and you end up making enantiomers. They're called enantiotopic. So if by replacing one hydrogen versus another, a pair of enantiomers are formed. The hydrogens are called enantiotopic. Why would it matter? You know, if you start out with something that was achiral, who cares if it has the potential to be chiral if it was substituted? Again, it's not that we're really going to substitute it. It's trying to get a particular structural relationship. And here's the relationship. Except this case, we're not going to compare two things on the same molecule. I'm going to take butane. And again, I'll write out two of its hydrogens. And now let me compare it or examine its interactions with a chiral molecule. Yes. Z means anything. In fact, it means nothing. It means that you're looking at one hydrogen's position versus another. And I know that this is going to be confusing, and I'll keep saying the same thing, but it won't sink in until you study it. We don't care that we're really substituting it one place or another. We're just talking about structurally, is there a difference between these two protons? The reason that in that previous case we have this word, diastereotopic, because that word means what would happen if you looked at the stereocenter versus its next position over. And I can't think of a better way to explain it at the moment, so I'll ask, review it over the break, and then when we come back on Monday, if you're still confused, ask me again. Now, this second case. So the top molecule is the one we're looking at, butane. Let's say it's dissolved in this chiral form of butane-2-ol. Well, in this particular interaction between these two molecules, now the OH group would have a different interaction with the hydrogen on a different molecule versus the hydrogen in back, which would have a different interaction with the hydrogen that's in back. Or another way of looking at it is this OH group when oriented with butane the way that's being written, will be closer to one hydrogen to butane than the other. But that means for that moment that the molecules are interacting, that the hydrogens are no longer equivalent to each other because of the molecule they're interacting with. Take the alcohol away, they go back to being equivalent again. So enantiotropic protons are chemically equivalent in achiral environments, but they're chemically inequivalent in chiral environments. Since most of the time we're going to use achiral solvents, enantiotropic protons will normally say are chemically equivalent. And any question where I might ask you, are these the same or not, I'd be sure to specify whether or not you have a chiral solvent or not. Now there is one more case, the simplest case, where no matter which hydrogen on a position you might replace, you always get the same molecule. Which means there's no possibility that by the different hydrogen you substitute, you're going to generate different interactions. And this is what would be true for a methyl group, for example. Even on a chiral molecule, if we have something like the methyl group that I'm pointing to on the right-hand side, doesn't matter whether you replace one or the other of those three hydrogens with some mythical group Z, you get the same molecule. So no matter which of the hydrogens at the end of this molecule are replaced, the exact same product would result. Meaning no stereocenter is formed. Therefore, the three hydrogens at that position are entirely equivalent. And so they're called homotopic protons. Homo meaning same, so the same result comes from substituting any of those hydrogens. Because it doesn't matter which one that you substitute, you always have the same structure that results. It doesn't matter if you're in an achiral environment or a chiral environment. There'll be no difference in interaction. And so homotopic protons are always chemically equivalent. Now, I have just one more problem to think about in terms of chemical equivalency for today. Cyclohexane. How many different types of protons exist in cyclohexane? Two, why? Axial versus equatorial protons, correct. But if you examine this compound at room temperature, you only get one NMR signal.
Now, our NMR spectrum, remember that the y-axis is intensity. Chemical shift starts at zero on the right, increases towards the left. And what I'm trying to get at is that at room temperature, you'll see a signal. At below room temperature, that will turn in sort of a broader signal. Way below room temperature, it starts to resolve into two different peaks. And way, 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 way below room temperature,
you'd actually get two distinct signals. What do you think's going on here? Why would it only look like one type of hydrogen at room temperature, but two types of hydrogen show up below room temperature? Do we remember about ring flips? Ring flip is just changing from one conformer to another, isn't it? Which, if you've played with your molecular models, you know that to do a ring flip, all you're really doing is making different rotamers. You're just twisting single bonds. Well, if you drop the temperature low enough, there's not enough energy to allow the single bonds to move. They're frozen, almost literally, in position. There's not enough energy for that twist to occur. So if the cyclohexane ring is not flipping back and forth, you'll have axial protons that are always axial, equatorial that are always equatorial, and two axial protons have a different interaction with each other that would lead to a steric interaction if you put any kind of substituent there, versus if you have an equatorial hydrogen that's pointed away from everything else. So way below room temperature, the ring flip isn't possible, and so you can distinguish the axial versus equatorial interactions. But at room temperature, the flip is happening so quickly that the machine, by the time it acquires the information, the molecule's already wiggled, already flipped a few times. And so you end up getting an average of the two signals. This is a problem in spectroscopy called the time scale problem, where if what you're doing to scan takes longer than what the molecule itself is doing, you won't see it. And this is a very classic example of that.
So let me write this down, a description. At room temperature, ring flips are occurring rapidly enough that the two types of hydrogen, which let me go back and label my chair form over here, we do have axial and equatorial substituents. So ring flips are occurring rapidly enough that the two types of hydrogens cannot be distinguished. So only one averaged signal results. Far below room temperature, the ring no longer flips, and so the two hydrogen types can be distinguished.
besides being an example of this time scale issue, it's also an example of how just because you identify a certain number of inequivalent protons, it doesn't always mean you're going to see that number of signals in your spectrum. Now, this is a sneakier case of why, but it's a good example of why. Questions on any aspect of chemical equivalency? Or are your brains so tired from the exam that you just need the weekend to recover and study? Yes. As long as you have a chiral center, regardless of what's on that chiral center, its next door neighbor could have a different interaction with the front or the back of that stereo center.
Okay, but the actual strength
would differ. Now, it shows up a lot for compounds with OH groups because they're so darn electronegative. So that's why I used it as my example. But no, it doesn't matter which functional group. It's just if you have that stereochemical relationship, you're going to have it. If you wanted to get a complete spectrum, yes.
So is that possible?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Our machine doesn't do variable temperature, but there are variable temperature MNMR machines. Yes. Yes. Well, let's take a 5-minute break or so, and then we'll gather again in the instrument room. First thing you need to know is there are two different programs that you're going to use. There is the data acquisition program, and then there's the spectrum processing program. So I'll refer to them as the blue screen for the data acquisition. Might not want to do that. And white screen for the processing application. If you come to the machine and neither of those are actually launched, we've got shortcuts in the start button here on the left. So the two programs are NUTS and PNMR. Again, white screen for processing, blue screen for data acquisition. The data acquisition program, there's only a very limited number of commands that you need to know. And using commands in this program is like you would normally use a computer. You type your command in, then hit the enter key. I know that sounds silly to comment on, but you're going to find out in this other program, it may be really good at analyzing spectra, but it's got an abysmally bad user interface. And one of the ways it's bad is that as soon as you type the last letter of the command, it starts executing that command. It doesn't wait for you to hit the enter key. So it violates the most fundamental of programming guidelines that have been around for the last 30 years, but oh well. But to the simple program first then. The blue screen program, there's just a little setup that you need to do. So the first command is NU, like nucleus. And that's to tell it what kind of nucleus that you're going to scan for, because we can do carbon NMR, we can do proton NMR. So you're going to type NU, then hit a space, and then type H1 for regular proton.
Does it matter, capital or?
Do everything lowercase. Right. So NU space H1, enter. That tells it you're going to do proton NMR.
Oh, so you just simply just type it in. Right?
Yep. Okay. NU space H1. Okay. Yeah, for those of you who were born many years after me, you may not have had to ever use much in the way of a command line prompt, but these machines and the programs that run them all are descended from older Unix systems. So many of the command names are themselves 30 years old, or this decade, 40 years old at this point. So there's sometimes not a really good explanation why things are called what they are, it's just tradition. So, after the nucleus command, if you're the first person on the machine that day, then you're going to type shim, S-H-I-M, as in Mary. If you're not familiar with that word in English, think of a table that has three legs that are the same length and one leg that's short, so that table will rock back and forth. The little thing that you stick under the leg to keep it from rocking, that's called a shim. And that comes up in other places like in woodworking and construction. It also comes up in terms for terminology related to NMR spectroscopy. So this is a big, huge iron magnet. But there is some control circuitry within the magnet to help maintain a completely consistent magnetic field. And in some cases, older cases, it might have actually been mechanical bits of iron that are being pulled in and out of that magnet. So kind of like the shim being the word for the little thing you stick under the table leg to make it balance out, shimming is what we call the process of homogenizing the magnet to get the best possible signal for acquiring your spectrum. Each different solution requires a slightly different shim. But if in the same day you're running very similar samples, you might only need the shim the first time you do any of those samples. And then the same set of parameters you can use for every scan in that same day. So it's not like a background. You're not acquiring something and subtracting it. You're just setting it up. But once you set it up, particularly in the case of what you all will be doing, scanning the same compound over and over again, you only need to shim once. When you hit the enter key for the shim command, it's going to come up with a little notice window and a place for you to type something. The notice window tells you about this thing called relaxation delay. So relaxation delay is related to the fact that the energy absorbed by these nuclei does not get released instantaneously. It doesn't just get released all of a sudden. It takes some time. So in between zapping the sample and acquiring a signal, you have to give it some time, and that's the relaxation delay. Details of that relaxation delay are beyond the level of this course. So we're just going to blindly follow what it says to do in that window, which is, if you have a very concentrated, viscous solution, you're going to tell it to have a 2-second delay. If you have a very dilute solution, you're going to tell it 5 seconds. Now, this morning, the machine was inoperational because the air system for the building had failed. So I'm not actually going to do the shim. But at this point, I would type in 5, for example, or because I would use a concentrated example to show you the scan, I'd put 2 in and then hit enter. It takes about 5 to 10 minutes, depending. So since it takes quite a while, that's why only the first person that uses the machine really should do the shim.
So,
yes?
So if you don't do the shim, what prompt would come up?
Nothing would come up. If it doesn't, it doesn't know whether you should or shouldn't shim. It just knows that if you tell it to shim, it's going to go ahead and do it. If you don't shim and it needed to be, we'll see later on how that'll make a bad-looking spectrum. All right? Now, what are the things... Yes?
What's the window delaying something?
The relaxation delay. So after you type shim in, it's going to ask, how long do you wait? Concentrated solutions tell it 2 seconds. So you just enter the number 2 and enter. And for dilute solutions, non-viscous solutions, 5 seconds. One benefit of doing the shim is it automatically sets what's called the receiver gain. So gain is kind of like volume. And so if you turn the gain up, that means it's going to amplify the signal or acquire with more sensitivity. Problem then becomes the same thing as what we have with the stereo system. If you, or even more specifically, recording something digitally, you know, in that process of taking digital information, you've got to convert a wave into a digital signal. Well, if the wave is so large that it's beyond the capacity of that digitizer,
then it basically turns into static. It turns into distortion, a form of digital distortion. Just like if you have a pair of speakers and you turn your stereo up too high, you're going to get sound that's bad. Same thing works in reverse. If you have a microphone that's turned up too sensitively, then you talk into it and it's going to sound like garbage. It's the same thing with the NMR signal. Shimming sets that volume level automatically. But if you don't do the shim, you might need to set that volume level. Now again, because we're going to be repeating the same sample over and over and over and over again, it might be that you don't really need to worry about the receiver gain. But I'm telling you about this command in case you need to use it. So the numbers for receiver gain go between 1 and 100. The bigger the number, the louder it is. So let's say that I did a scan and the sensitivity was turned up too high. When displayed on the screen, the scan's going to be red. If you scan it and it's within its normal operating parameters, it's going to display as yellow. If you don't see anything, though, if no signal comes out, that might mean you need to turn the volume up. So, to change receiver gain is just simply RG. Then space and then whatever number you want to put in. So right now, on the left-hand side here, it tells me my current receiver gain is 16. Let's say I need to cut that in half. So I'll make it RG space 8. It'll change the gain to 8 instead. I could then reacquire the spectrum and then hope that that would be within acceptable parameters, that it would not be red. And so it's a little trial and error if you're doing it manually. My suggestion is whoever does the shim first, just afterwards stick with that same receiver gain unless you're having problems with the spectrometer. And with a little time and experience, you'll learn how to say, oh, need to do it again. Red means you have a bad spectrum because the volume, you could say, is turned up too high. The receiver gain is too high, and so you have to set it at a lower value.
Okay. And the yellow one means
something? It's fine. Now, fine means not too loud. Fine might mean too little signal. And so we'll see an example of that later. There are only two other commands. So I've only listed three commands so far. NU, which is where you tell it what nucleus. Shim, which is to adjust the magnetic field. RG, if you want to change the volume. And then NS is number of scans. Generally, if you're doing the receiver gain, you want to tell it beforehand to only do one scan at a time. So then it will just do the one scan, which you can see if it's set at the right settings or not.
How do you do one scan?
NS space 1, and then hit enter. But when you really are ready to get your spectrum, there is a glitch in the machine that sometimes generates a false signal. Instead of fixing the machine, so far we've just been using this trick to get around it, which is if you make the number of scans a multiple of 4, for whatever reason, those errors cancel out and that extra signal disappears. So when you're getting ready to really do your spectrum, NS space 4, to tell it to do 4 scans. Each scan will only take maybe 10, 15 seconds. So it's not a huge amount of time. Maybe it's even less than that. So longer than the IR, but still not too bad. The one is for when you're wanting to do the receiver game. Because you don't need to sit there and have it scan multiple times and waste time if all you're trying to do is make sure your volume's set correctly. So in that case, you might want to say NS equals 1. In fact, let me try something here. When you load the NU command, which generally it's only the first person that day that will type that in, because everybody else afterwards is going to be doing Proton, it will set the number of scans to 1 automatically. But when you go to actually do your compound, what I'm telling you is I'm suggesting to do 4 scans at a time. The very last command you need to know then is Z as in zebra, G. ZG, 0 and go.
It means clear out your data and acquire a new spectrum.
So
ZG, enter. When you hit enter, it's going to ask you for a file name. But just like on the IR, we don't save things under our own file name, so just hit enter, whatever comes up. All right? Because the machine was not calibrated this morning, though, we're not going to sit here and wait for it to scan. I already have a scan in memory from the last time the machine was used. So now we'll switch over to the processing program, the white screen program. In the future, after you do this first scan, I will tell you some shortcut commands where you'll hardly have to do anything in this processing program. It will do most of it for you. But so that you can understand what's going on, and also just in case you happen to transfer in a program later on where you're using NMR and it's not all automated, that you at least have some clue what goes on behind the scenes. So we're going to do it the long, painful way the first time. And then after you're familiar with it, then we'll just do the shortcuts. Part of the reason I'm showing you the long way is that every once in a while the shortcuts don't work, and so then you have to adjust your spectrum a little bit. And if you don't know the long way, you're kind of stuck at that point. So, this is divided up into three sections. First is just preparation of the spectrum. Second is labeling the different peaks. Just like we label it on IR. It's a little more complicated on this machine. And the last is something called integrals. If you haven't had calculus, an integral is a function which one use of it is to find the area under a curve. The peaks that we get from NMR, those areas have a linear relationship to the number of hydrogens that really are present. So if we know the areas, and we know that, say, one peak is twice the area than the other, we know there's twice as many hydrogens associated with that peak versus the other. So, preparation, peaks, and integrals. Let's do the preparation first. First thing is get the spectrum into the processing program. ZZ. Why is it called that? No clue. It just is.
Is it enter?
ZZ. No.
Oh.
No, in this program, the enter key gets you out of a command. Ends a command. So, and you all are going to be so annoyed by that at first, because you're going to be typing along like any normal human does. Type, 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 hit enter. You don't hit enter in this program. All right? So ZZ, I've pulled the spectrum. But notice, here's the baseline in red, the zero axis, you could say. But then notice that the scan is floating above it. And that's because in this digitizer, even if there's no signal, it interprets the signal as a voltage. And effectively what this means is zero voltage is not zero. So we have to make an adjustment, a direct current adjustment. So you type DC. D as in dog, C as in cat. Now look at the screen when I type the second letter. Look at the left-hand side of the screen. A scroll bar appears. No labels what that scroll bar is supposed to mean. And no indication in the program you're doing this direct current adjust. This is a very actively user unfriendly program. Yes. So you just have to know that when you see that scroll bar floating there, oh, that means I can move the spectrum up and down. Now you can either grab the scroll bar tab in the middle, or I suggest using the arrows to have a little bit better control over it.
The scroll bars come up after you hit DG.
After you hit, that's right. And it's the scroll bar on the left. You'll always have a scroll bar on the right, but that's to zoom in and out vertically on your spectrum. So once you have set the scroll bar on the left to have the spectrum in the right place, like any other command in the program, hit enter to stop it. You hit enter, the scroll bar disappears, and your adjustment is kept.
So how do you do that?
DC.
DC again to move the scroll bar.
DC, and then just use the scroll bar with the mouse. Get it so that the spectrum lies right on that axis, and then hit enter. All right.
Why would there's a space in between the red and the blue?
Because this program, for whatever reason, won't let you go in steps smaller than whole numbers. Why, I don't know. They must know better than us. So next command. This is what we call the free induction decay, that FID that I talked about during the lecture. You can see there's this the decaying signal that has these little hints of waves in the middle of them, or this other second wave that generates afterwards. But that's not what we want. We want the spectrum with each of the frequencies plucked out of it. So I want the Fourier transform, F as in Frank, T as in Tom. Foxtrot Tango. And there's our NMR spectrum, except what looks funny? Well, here, let me shrink it a little bit. But yeah, it looks like it kind of looks like a heart monitor. The peak looks rounded on the left and then drops off on the right. This is a problem with what's called phasing, which in order to really get what phasing is, we'd have to get way into NMR theory, which we're not going to in this course. It's beyond the level of the course. But let's just say that there's a frame of reference that involves a wave. Waves themselves have phase, and so if you tell it the wrong place to start looking at the wave, you're going to get these funny signals that look like this. So, they look like it. And yes, actually, in a way they are. But we need to fix that then. So to phase it, PH for phase. This command is a little user-friendlier, because at least down at the bottom of the screen, it will tell you that you're phasing. To get out of the phasing routine, you're going to hit enter. So PH to get in. Once you're in there, you're going to use your mouse. First your left mouse button, then your right mouse button. So you click and hold the first mouse button, the left mouse button first. While you're holding it down, move the mouse left and right, and look what happens to the spectrum. It dips to the left versus the right, and notice how the whole spectrum is shifting. So you want to move it around until you get it so that the baseline, the bottom part of the spectrum, is as even and symmetric and flat on either side of all the peaks as you can get it. While you're doing the phasing, you hold down the left mouse button. While holding the left mouse button, you move the mouse.
What about the right mouse?
Hadn't gotten there yet.
Oh, okay.
So you first do it with the left mouse button. You get where the spectrum looks good according to that. And then you click and hold the right mouse button and do the same thing. Now, if you notice, in this case, now the right-hand side of the spectrum is doing a lot more than the left. And that has to do with the polynomial that's being used to shim or to phase with. The left-hand mouse button would be the first term, the first polynomial term. The right mouse button corresponds to the second term. Ignoring anything about polynomials, just know the left mouse button does the adjustment evenly to the whole spectrum. The right mouse button mainly does the right-hand side. But after you adjust it, you then hit the enter key, it will keep your adjustment.
Enter
after. To get out of the phase command, but keep the changes that you made.
So we do the PH, not enter, now we adjust that button, right?
Nope. PH, then the left and right button, then enter. Enter is always the last thing that you do. The right button is also for phasing, but it's called the first order phasing, or actually I think it's technically second order. So it's a different kind of phasing than the left mouse button.
How do we know it's done?
You have to do it by observation. So let me show you what it looks like when it's off, and then watch what happens as I adjust it.
Is it the right or left? Is it left?
Left first, then the right. So you adjust it using the left first, get it where it looks okay.
You put it on the red line?
You want the shape symmetric and flat on either side of all the peaks. So if you look at the way I've got it right now, they're all dipping on the left-hand side. Now if I go too far the other way, they're dipping on the right-hand side. You want it where it doesn't dip on either side. You want it flat.
Doesn't matter if you're on the red line or not. Just get it symmetric and even.
That's right.
No,
for all of them. Look, the whole spectrum moves when I do it. The right mouse button does the whole spectrum, but does the right-hand side more. In order to explain why, would be math beyond, again, the detail level of this course. So you'll just have to accept that you do it the way I'm describing it, that you make it as symmetric on either side as you can. And then hit enter to keep what you did. Yes.
After you hit enter.
Yes.
If you want to face it.
Then you hit PH again.
Okay.
Get back into the phasing command if you want to go fix what you just did.
Okay.
All right. Next command. The baseline is not flat, though, all the way across. So there's the F as in Frank, B as in boy.
Uh-oh.
The flatten baseline command. All these pinkish boxes appear. Well, each one of those boxes represents an area of the spectrum the computer thinks is a flat part of the spectrum. Now, where my finger is right now, though, I can see this little absorbance, which means it's not flat, which means the computer really shouldn't be counting it. So I'm going to click on the box to turn it off. Let's say that I had a whole region of the spectrum that, for whatever reason, it missed. But I can see that it's a very flat region of the spectrum. So then I'll click to turn those on. So you click, it turns it off, click, it turns it on. And you want the pink boxes everywhere that the spectrum is flat. Once you have that, hit the C button for calculate. It'll show you on the left-hand side the parameters it's using for whatever polynomial is involved with this. And again, to keep the results, you're going to hit enter. There's only one last adjustment now, which is to tell it where chemical shift zero is. Because we even once after we set up the machine, there's still some drift that can occur as far as the magnetic field strength. And if the magnetic field strength drifts a little bit, and I'm not talking about it being unbalanced, but just the whole field increases or decreases, well, then it's going to throw off your chemical shift value. So the right-hand most peak, I know from the way this was done the last time, that is the TMS peak, which should be at zero, but we can see that it's not. So now let me show you a command that's not in order. It can be used almost any time. It's the zoom command, Z-O. When I type ZO, again, this is one of the friendlier commands where it actually shows you what's going on. And in fact, it puts your little ZO on the cursor there, so it reminds you. To zoom in, click and drag with the left mouse button. That will choose the region of the spectrum that you want to zoom in on. Then click the right-hand mouse button in that region. That will be what actually causes it to zoom. Like any other command, though, you've got to hit enter to get out of that command. So you hit enter, and the zoom cursor disappears. If you want to go back to full screen, control F for full. So let me describe that again. ZO, which it'll remember the last region you selected. And it's already put it up on the screen here. Let's say I wanted to narrow, though, what I was looking at. So I can click and drag with the left mouse button, and each time I do, it starts selecting a new area. So click and drag with the left mouse button. Click in the area with the right mouse button. And then hit enter to pop out of zoom mode. Popping out of zoom mode doesn't cause the spectrum to collapse again. It just makes it where you're not trying to zoom any further. Back onto the trail of commands that you should follow. To tell it a particular value for a chemical shift, for a specific peak, we're going to use the V command. To do that, while you're in what's called the base level, which means you're not doing any other command, which if you want to make sure that you're at that base level, hit enter a couple of times. Once you're there, click and hold the left mouse button. You'll see a cursor pops up. And on the bottom of the screen, it shows you where you're located on the spectrum. Move your mouse so that the vertical line is right through the middle of the peak that you want to calibrate. And while you're holding it there, so if you let go, the cursor disappears. So while you're holding the mouse button down, hit V. It'll automatically have highlighted a box next to PPM here, and that horizontal dimension, what it's really asking you is, what is the chemical shift? It is zero for this TMS peak, so I'm going to hit zero and hit enter. And you can see that now the peak is in the right position. I'll do Control F so you can better see that. So zooming is a command that has nothing to do with processing the spectrum, per se. So you can do the zoom at any time. But I zoomed in on the TMS peak so I could better see where the middle of it was. While I was in observation mode, I hit the left mouse button, which brought this, see the cross hairs up? And I'm going to move it so that the vertical line's right through the middle of the peak. It's there that if I hit V, I can tell it that the chemical shift is supposed to be zero. So one quick review of all the commands that you've seen so far. ZZ to just pull the spectrum into the machine. DC so that you can move the spectrum up or down. Enter to get out of that. FT to do the Fourier transform. PH to mouse phase. Click and hold the left mouse button, make the spectrum look better. Click and hold the right mouse button, make the spectrum look better. Hit enter to keep those changes. Flatten the baseline with the FB command. Click off and on the different boxes until only flat parts of the spectrum are selected, and hit C for calculate. Enter to get out of that command. Last thing is to tell it where zero is. So I'm going to click and hold. Make sure you're not in zoom mode or it won't let you do this. Click and hold, hit V, and then type in zero and enter.
What had changed when you click zero? The current data was all the...
The axis moved.
Why you choose that thing?
Because it's TMS. And TMS is defined as zero.
Mm-hmm. Why not the...
Because you don't know what they are.
That's calibration then.
Right. If you're running a sample and you don't know where the chemical shifts are, how can you calibrate to those chemical shifts? So TMS is the reference, and that's why we use it to define where zero is.
And what do you use FT for?
Fourier transform to go from the original signal into this kind of spectrum. That's, yes.
You just hit the letter, or you hit shift or command?
You just type the letters in, no shift or anything, but just the letters themselves.
Okay. After FD, you press enter or PH?
After there is no command that you hit enter to make it do anything. Enter is to stop a command. So after FT, it's already done it. So the next thing would be PH to phase it. All right, that's the end of section 1. Section 2 let's figure out what the values are for these peaks. One of the commands is very easy. Pick peak, PP. And you see it puts all these values up here for you automatically. PP, peak, pick. Or pomegranate, pomegranate. After you do that, though, it might miss some peaks. In this case, I would look through and say, ooh, it caught all the major peaks. I'm already done. But what if you have a specific place in the spectrum that you want to show there's a peak there and it misses it? And just for argument's sake, I'll just say something over here I maybe want to label. So then I've got to manually put the peak in. To do that, it's DP, define peak. In the BP command, if you click, it makes a new peak. You keep on clicking, it'll keep finding new peaks. If you accidentally are click happy and you put too many peaks in there, one that shouldn't exist, if you hit the K button, it gets rid of the last one that you just did. K for kill. A very violent subroutine. If you want to get rid of all of them and start over again, hit the C button. And this is while you're in this DP program. So DP to do things with peaks. Click to make one. K to get rid of the last one. C to get rid of all of them. Mm-hmm. So I've gone through and redid the automatic one. Now let me tell you, sometimes, especially when you use the DP command, once you hit enter to tell it keep the information that you just made, to get out of the DP command, the peaks will disappear. They didn't really disappear though, it just hid them so that you're not crowding your spectrum with a bunch of information. So if you need to turn off or on the peaks being shown, it's Control P.
While you're
in base level.
You're out of the DP.
Even in DP it would work.
Control
P.
They're just trying to play the spectrum, not
look here. Look at the top of the spectrum. The numbers are appearing and disappearing. I'm going to make them disappear for now just so we don't see this while we're doing the next step, which is to get integrals. So now section 3. To do integrals, ID. Now if you look at the screen, you can see this gray line going across it. That's called the integral trace. And pretty much what happens is you start on the left-hand side of the screen, or the computer does, and it adds the value of the spectrum as it goes from left to right. So what that does then, it gives you the area under each curve. And again, that area is going to correspond to how many hydrogens do you have. Now, a few commands related just to this line. One is there is phasing for integrals, just like there's phasing for the spectrum itself. And you want the integrals to be as flat as possible in between each peak. Why? Because if you're adding these values up and you don't have a good integral trace, you're going to get the wrong integral value, which means it might give you the wrong number of hydrogens that are really there. It's hard to get an ideal trace. This is an okay one. Why is it okay? Because it's pretty flat on the left, it's pretty flat on the right, and it's relatively flat in between. If we wanted to play with it and make it better, while we're in integral mode, hit B for baseline. It won't show you that anything has changed. But now you can take the left and right mouse buttons and move the integral up and down and adjust its shape just in the same way you could with the phasing.
said B?
B, as in boy. Now, you can see that it's going off the screen here if I move it too much. So you can shrink the integrals down by using the scroll bar on the left. So I'll play with the phasing, and I'll get it where it looks a little bit more like it's flat in between. It's actually pretty good to start with. Once you're happy with it, hit enter. But only hit enter once. And this is confusing, but you were already inside the integral program, and then you told it to do this baseline command. So the first enter that you hit is to get out of the baseline command. But you're still in the integral command. After that, you've got a couple of other commands. If, again, you use the left-hand scroll bar, you can blow up the size of the integral trace or shrink it down. What if you want to move the whole thing up or down a little bit? Hit Z as in zebra. To add one bad user interface approach to another, you now have two scroll bars on the left. Neither one of them is labeled. Of those two, the one on the right moves the whole trace up and down. Doesn't shrink or expand it, it just moves it. The one on the left is still the original one that will grow or shrink the size of the trace. If you hit enter once, one of the scroll bars disappears, and you're back to regular integral mode. Now, the real thing that you need to do is to tell it where the peaks are. Because if you're adding up areas under the curve, you need to tell it where's the start of the curve, where's the end. This takes a little practice to determine. In this particular one that's on the screen now, it's relatively easy. Because if you look at the left-hand side of the peak, you can see where it touches down at the baseline. So I click once to bring up this cursor. I'm going to move it so that the cursor is right to the left, immediately to the left of the peak, at the baseline. I'll click a second time. That leaves a green marker there. You move the mouse over to the right-hand side of that same peak, and then click the mouse one last time. You'll see that all is left is the little bit of integral for that individual peak. All right? We do that for every one of the peaks. Click to bring up the cursor, click on the left, click on the right. Click, left, right. Click, left, right. Click, left, right. No, when I say left and right, it doesn't mean the left and right mouse buttons, though. So I'm clicking first on the left side of the peak and then the right side.
So you click first to get the red line.
Exactly.
And then you click left again to get the green on the left.
That's right. Correct, I mean.
And then, I'm just trying to make sure.
No, you got it.
Okay. And then click again on the right to get the interface.
That's right. Okay. That's correct. I can't say left or right, because if I say right, does that mean left, right, or right, right?
Right, that's correct.
Right, exactly. Okay? Let's say that you did one too many integrals, that you got click happy, and you select something that wasn't really an integral. Well, whoever wrote this part of the program must have been a little less violent, because instead of K for killing the last integral, it's L for get rid of the last. Why the difference? Because one program probably didn't talk to the other. If you want to get rid of all the integrals and start over again, that's the same. It's C for clear. So you got a whole bunch of commands inside of the integral command. Again, they included things like the B command for fixing the baseline, the Z command for moving it up and down, the L command to get rid of the last integral that you cut up, and the C command to clear out everything that you did with integrals. Once you're done with all that, there's only one more command, which is the same V command that you used to tell it the chemical shift. Except in this case, you're going to tell it how many hydrogens are there. Of course, the natural question is, well, how many hydrogens are there? How are we supposed to know that? Well, you don't until you've got a little experience. Because if you know that you were trying to make a particular compound and you're convinced you made it, well, then you have to know about enough about the spectrum, enough about the compound to say, oh, well, that signal means that's one hydrogen. Otherwise, you don't know and you have to make a reasonable guess. For your first compound that you'll scan, I will tell you which peak corresponds to how many hydrogens. For this compound that's on the screen right now, the leftmost peak corresponds to one hydrogen. So, I'm going to click, but hold the mouse button down. It brings up that same red cursor that we had before. So I'm not going to let go, or it's going to think I'm trying to make a new integral. While holding down the button, I'm going to move on top of the integral I want to calibrate. And while it's there, I hit the V button. It comes up saying current relative value. Relative because the machine doesn't measure protons, it's just measuring an electromagnetic signal. So it thinks the area is 1,389,184.1. I want to tell it that means one hydrogen, so I'm going to type the number 1 in and hit enter. Notice that it pops these other numbers up for the other integrals, which we got 1.00, which that's pretty darn good. But then we got 1.76, which is close to 2, but it's not quite 2. How come it's off? Maybe my baseline was bad. Maybe my integral wasn't well phased. Maybe I need to calibrate the machine and get a better spectrum.
Can I ask for
that? Yes.
After you clean the left side mouse and move to the pink, then you enter the V.
So let me show you this integral part one more time. So let's say that I've got the baseline flattened. I've already done the phasing for it. So the cut up part, click to bring up the cursor, go to the left of it, click, go to the right of it, click. And you repeat that for all the different peaks that are there. Notice that since I've already put in some calibration information, once I make that third click and the cursor disappears, it puts up the integral value on there for you. And once you've already isolated all your integrals, if you want to go back and adjust the value that's there, then that's where you click and hold and then hit the V button. Once you've done that, hit enter to get out of the integral command. But you notice the integrals just disappeared, except they didn't. It's just like the peak program. It sometimes gets it off the screen just so you're not flooding the screen with information. So to turn those on and off, it's control I. You're now done processing. The last thing to do is to print it out. When we print it out, it's always good to zoom in on just the part of the spectrum that actually matters, you could say. Because the more you spread the spectrum out, then the easier it is to see the peaks and also the easier it is to see the numbers. So I'm going to zoom in on just the part of the spectrum that's got something interesting going on. I'm going to turn back my peaks on because I turned them off earlier. So remember, that's Control P. If you're the first person to use this each day, and actually each person, there's some hang up in this program where it keeps forgetting that it should be printing in landscape mode. So up at the menu here on under File, if you go to Printer Setup and just make sure that it's set to landscape. Then to print, I would just hit the little print icon. Now, to show you how long this should take once you're really familiar with the program, let me just quit out of the program so we load the spectrum in fresh again. All right?
You're gonna fly.
Well, I've got a little practice. But yes, ZZ to read in the scan. DC to DC adjust it, move it down to the axis, enter to keep that information. FT to Fourier transform it, PH to phase it. Left mouse button first, move the mouse. Right mouse button second, move the mouse. Enter to keep the phasing information. FB to flatten the baseline, turn off the boxes that shouldn't be there, turn on the ones that should. Hit C for calculate, enter to keep that. I'm going to zoom in on the TMS peak.
Click, hold, hit V to tell it what value it should be, which is 0. Control F, get me back to the full screen. PP for peak picking mode. DP if I want to select an additional peak, like chloroform that shows up at 2.6 or 7.26 normally. Enter to get out of DP mode. Control P to get off the screen temporarily. ID to turn the trace on. B to adjust the phasing of that trace. Enter to keep what I've got. Click, 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 click on the left and the right to chop up that integral. Then click, hold on the last one and tell it its value. Enter to get out of integral mode. Control I to turn the integrals back on. Control P to turn the peaks back on. Zoom in on only the part of the spectrum you care about, and you're ready to print. Most of that is what the shortcut command will do for you later on. But that was what, about 2 minutes? So multiply that by 5. That means each one of you, within a little bit of practice, should be able to do this in 10 minutes or less. And I haven't decided yet, but I may only give you a time limit of 15 minutes per person. Because if you've been paying attention, you're very confused. But if you watch the first person do it, you'll say, oh, I remember that. Oh, you know, no, you need to do that next. You'll start remembering the commands. So whoever gets to go first on the machine, I'll be here and help you lead you through it. Whoever else is available should be standing right behind them watching so that you can learn. In theory, if I show Fenir how to work the machine and she gets through it all, then when I go to Miet, she should do it more quickly than Fen did because she was watching what Fen's doing. And if I move to the next person, the next person, the next person, each one of you should learn without me having to show you, if your observation skills are good, each person should be a little quicker than the next. That's how I'm hoping this is going to work. Now, since this is a lot of information, I'm not going to expect that you can sit down and do it in 2 minutes like I do. But if you are pretty lost, use some of the time over the break to review these NMR commands. I will post the audio of this. I have a cheat sheet that I need to see if I have a clean copy of. I'll look for that tonight. If I can't find it, I'll take this one tomorrow when I do the other sections lecture and just scan this in, because it's got a lot of the commands already on here. Don't depend on that. I'm just saying, if you're confused, review your notes so you can come in with questions or be ready to watch the next time we do it again. Yes?
So you had said that they're shortcuts, right? But we're just going to do the long way.
The first time, the long way.
Oh, so we're going to do this more than once.
Oh, yes. Every lab next quarter, ideally, if we can get trained well enough, every experiment you do NMR. Because that's what an organic chemist would do. This is the technique that gives us a spectrum. I could look at that and say that's next to a methyl group. I don't know what this molecule is, but because there's 4 peaks here, I know that that means there's 3 neighbors. 3 neighbors means it's a next to a methyl group. So you're going to learn how to interpret this. This peak here that's split into 3, it's next to 2 hydrogens. So I would guess, not knowing anything else without analyzing further, that maybe this methyl group is next to that, or vice versa. Or yeah, this is the methyl group that this is next to. How could I also tell that? Because this integrates to 3. There are 3 hydrogens on that peak. This integrates to 2, which 2 hydrogens would cause the split into 3 symbols. That's how we analyze NMR spectrum. But that's for our next lecture. And that is enough for today.